The United States Army Air Force is off for Berlin.
Ready for war, sir. Ready for war.
The magnificence of the courage and fortitude of the Korean people defies description.
Other battles were raging in the streets of Saigon.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
There has been unusual American air activity in the area of the Persian Gulf.
We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential.
Afghanistan is a war that we had to fight and we have to win.
This is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join our honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
To the present day.
In Afghanistan and Iraq, 50 million people are now living in freedom.
Now, the American Veterans Center and Radio America present Veterans Chronicles. Today on Veterans Chronicles, host Gene Pell sits down with Newcomb Nuke Eldridge, Army veteran of the famed 10th Mountain Division during World War II. Prior to joining the Army, Eldridge had extensive experience as a skier, beginning the sport as a young boy at the age of 8. He joined the Army in 1943, training at Camp Hale in Colorado. In December 1944, he left for Europe and would see combat in the mountains of Italy. His efforts in the battle for Mount Belvedere would earn him the Purple Heart, as well as two Bronze Stars. He begins his story by talking about his early years growing up in Pittsburgh.
So you were born in Rush?
No, actually I was born in Baltimore, Maryland, but came to Pittsburgh when I think was 2 years old.
Okay. So that was your early upbringing.
Yes. I graduated from Pittsburgh School, where we went from kindergarten in the same building to senior year. So as we grew and our legs got bigger, we make it to the second floor and then to the third floor when you got to be a freshman.
Yeah. Well, let's start there in Pittsburgh, because yes. I always like to ask about the early influences on people such as yourself and what you remember about growing up and what has carried through your career.
Well, I remember something that was very influential, and that was ski jumping. Powder Mill Park, which is about 5 miles from Pittsburgh, the CCC built a 35-meter jump and a 20-meter jump. And so there were a few of us kids who loved skiing. We loved jumping. And Joe Jigley was our coach. He was a Swiss. Then there was J.D. Whiting, and these guys were characters, and we had a lot of fun jumping. Bill is a good jumper. In our club, of course, J.D., Joe Jigley, had their own jumping skis. When we practiced, we would jump on our downhill skis. But when we were ever in competition, we had one pair of skis for the club. And so we got a special dispensation to take our three jumps, one after the other. You know, because then you have to give the skis to the next guy, and his foot is going to be a little different in yours, so you got to adjust the bindings to fit.
How old were you when you started jumping?
Oh, gosh, probably. Well, as a kid, I probably was around 8, 9.
Okay.
Yeah, we lived on the Erie Canal. We had a big steep hill, and my father fashioned a jump. And they used to lower the water in the Erie Canal, which is also called the Barge Canal. And so it made a perfect landing hill. And so I had fun learning that and doing flips and flops. And
Well, that was an obvious early influence that led to at least part of your military career.
Right. Well, I had a friend who was also on our jumping group who joined the 10th about a year and a half before me. And he used to write letters to his mother, and his mother would have them published in the Pittsburgh Post. And Wilson's letter sounded like, good God, sounds like Sun Valley. And so, well, this is the outfit for me. So I ended up, and I found out it wasn't quite Sun Valley. And I happened to be in the same battalion as this guy, Dick Wilson, who's a good writer. I said, boy, you're a real propaganda artist. And I said, your mother used to have those printed in the Pittsburgh Post. I said, Wilson, gosh, you really do piling on.
Well, Sun Valley is certainly, Watertown, rather, is certainly no Sun Valley.
Oh, that's for sure.
No doubt about that. What prompted you to go in the military?
I had no choice in 43. Right. Yeah. So I tried for Bill's outfit, the Navy Air Force. Went through, took the mental exam, you know, and then the physical. The last test that they gave me was the Hiss-Hara test. Familiar with that for color blindness? It's a bunch of round things with numbers. I did pretty well in the first three pages. Then I couldn't see anything after that. And so they were nice. They said, well, you're not really colorblind. You got a color weakness, but you don't qualify. So the next thing was the ski troops. Of course, you had to volunteer, and then you had to have three letters of recommendation that you were a skier, a climber, or somebody who experienced to show that they could survive in the harsh, cold weather. And I would say in the majority of men who joined, boys who joined, were skiers. And then there were some real good mountaineering experts, rock climbers, ice climbers, and people from all things, you know, like Park Service, people, National Forest, anybody who had anything to do with the outdoors. And we ended up having some incredible, you know, people in the tent. I think of Brower. Brower was the man who was the executive secretary of the Mountaineering Club, Sierra. And he was a very good rock climber and ice climber, but he spent a lot of his time in the mountains, and he's the man who saved the Grand Canyon. And because he was seeing firsthand in Italy what was happening to the Alps, seeing the Alps being the ski areas, the climbing areas being overexposed, and which he said, which is true, was not a very good thing. When you overuse the forest, overuse the trails, and there was another guy by the name of Paul Petzl. Paul Petzl was the head of the mountain school, let's see. Of course, there was Outward Bound, and the guy who was the head of that was Tapley. He was a 10th guy. And then there was another school that was a little more specialized that Petzl started. I can't think of the name of it right now. One of their mottos was, leave no tracks behind. Clean up your mess, you know. Make sure that nobody knows that you were in the forest. And Petzl, in 1938, Petzl was on the 1938, K2 Expedition, which is the second highest mountain in the world, much tougher than Everest. Technically, it's, you know, it's very steep, and so you have to really do a lot of technical climbing, you know, as you approach the summit. And Petzold was known as the man who got to the highest point in the world before the war. He got up within, I don't know how many feet of the summit, but he had a Sherpa with him, and he needed the Sherpa. And the Sherpa stopped and would refuse to go any further because, you know, they have, I guess, spirits and so forth. I don't understand their religion, but he refused to go. And so, I mean, Petzold couldn't get him to go. And Petzold was not going to risk climbing by himself, which is a smart thing.
But where did you train after you were in the military?
Okay. We trained at Camp Hale in Colorado, which is near Leadville, 9,200 feet. And the original battalion started out at Mount Rainier, Fort Lewis, and then they trained at Paradise. And that was 1941, before the war. Of course, the guys stayed at Paradise Lodge. And, you know, there's a lot of propaganda about the ski troops and the mountain troops. And you'd see it on television and whatnot. It looked pretty glamorous with these guys skiing and then staying in Paradise Lodge. But in 42, they built Camp Hale. They built it 9 months to accommodate 14,000 people, soldiers. There were 12 in the 10th. And so that's where I ended up.
When we return, Eldridge recounts his experiences as he and his fellow troops arrived in Italy in December of 1944.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. World War II Army veteran Nuke Eldridge saw action as a ski trooper in the mountains of Italy at the battle for Mount Belvedere. He continues his story, expanding upon his initial arrival in Italy near the town of Pisa, close to the Italian front, as well as his initial encounters with the enemy.
So that camp was built. It was ready for occupancy in November, December of 42. And then the division began to form. The first regiment was the 87th. Then there's the 86th regiment, and then the 85th. And so as the men flowed into the division, they began to fill out these other regiments.
And when did you first leave for Europe?
It would be in November, December of 44. Now, some of the units of the 10th got over in November, and they were on the front. Our regiment didn't get there until December, early December of '44.
So when you got to Italy, what did you find?
Well, we didn't get much to see in Italy. We ended up in, trying to think of the name of the village, it's on the seacoast. Well, anyway, some of us went by train from Naples, and others went by a landing craft, and it was very close to the front. So we bivouacked in the King's Garden, and this is somewhat near Pisa. But there's a... So when we embarked, then we getting trained, and within days, we were on the front, and pretty quick.
Well, from sea level to pretty high up, right?
Yeah. I'm thinking in Riva Ridge, probably about 5,000 feet, and Belvedere, probably close to 4,000. So the mountains are more or less, I would call them, you know, very similar to the White Mountains. They're steep, they're rugged, and hard to maneuver around there. We did use a lot of mules. They supplied us. We artillery were mules. So our supplies were supplied by mules, you know, to a certain point, then they were hand-carried by the soldiers to the position.
So did you encounter the enemy right away?
Well, from a shelling standpoint, yes.
Uh-huh.
But then later on, there were patrols and... Of course, a lot of snow at that time, particularly in January and early February. And there were a lot of ski patrols that went out. However, as luck would have it, all our equipment ended up in New York, not in Italy. Typical. And so we were using Italian Alpini equipment, captured German mountain troop equipment, you know, for skis and crampons and stuff like that. So we didn't have the equipment that we really needed. And so some of the patrols, I mean, the ski patrols, they were fun. I never had a chance to go on one, wanted to. But we had, you know, oh, gosh, probably a mile and a half between the American front and the German front. And so you ski on down into no man's land, and the skiing looked great. And so sometimes the 10th and the Germans would end up crossing each other. And fortunately, the Germans knew that we were green troops. So they, I heard, would speak to the Americans, you know, in English, and say, oh, what a great ski run, or something like this. Because I think most of us would have, you know, what do? Shoot them?
Well, that's interesting. There's a certain camaraderie that exists even in certain adverse conditions with people who share something.
Yeah, right.
So tell me about the incident that where you took the mortar hit.
It was... April 14th, it was Hill 913, and this was the final assault or attack in Italy. Then I'll speak about it later on as to why it was necessary. And my regiment, my battalion, and my company, we were the assault, meaning you're first in.
After the break, Eldridge continues describing his encounters with enemy troops and the role he and his company played in the final assault on Italy.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Vietnam area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network. Radio America and the American Veterans Center. This is Veterans Chronicles.
Ski trooper Nuke Eldridge of the 85th Regiment, 10th Mountain Division, shares his role in the Italian campaign of the Second World War, a component of the European theater, which historically has received less attention. He continues his story now, discussing the injury he received while engaged in the final assault of Italy.
We're coming down from our mountainside and got down to the valley. There was an old roadway there, and the Germans had taken an incredible amount of fire from the 10th, but there are all sorts other artillery outfits up there, British, and just covering this whole front was on fire with the artillery. And you thought nobody could live under that concentration. And I understand it was the biggest concentration since Casino. And then we get down, we deploy, and it's quiet. And then suddenly, all this machine gun fire from the Germans is coming, you know, across like this. Well, the Germans had dug down. They had foxholes that went down quite a distance and underneath, and they left their weapons up on top, which were many machine guns. And so when that, you know, when it stopped and then the machine gun fire, oh my, that was incredible. And we were in a hedgerow. We were deployed. And by this time, I'm acting sergeant, and I look down the hedgerow, saying, God, oh, right before that, I notice coming in on my right side where the machine gun bullets were, there are two tracer bullets. That indicates that they're pointing out to the mortar observers, this is where the enemy is. So, you know, from experience, you know, the mortar is going to be in on you very shortly. But then you've got the machine gun fire that's making you hesitate to what's worse. And so I look down to see Lieutenant Hurst, what's going to happen, and taking the lead from him. And he stands up, and bingo, he gets it in the neck, and blood comes spurting out, and he goes down. And then, knowing the tracer bullets, I told the Wales Kennedy next to me, I said, "Wales, we got to get out of here. We got to, you know." And we had a lot of replacements with us. Everybody is scared, but replacements are more scared. You know, they don't know what to do. So we went over the hedgerow. We're going up toward this machine gun position, using the old infantry track aches, you know, hitting the ground, rolling, and getting up and running. And then the next thing I know, I get hit. And I can't see, but I have this vision. I'm just going up and up and up. And I'm coming down and down and down. And the next thing I know, I'm on the ground. And then I can't see. You remember Neil Dearborn, called Curly, was a good friend of mine. He was the medic. He came over and bandaged me up, then carried me off to a shell hole because he had lots of other guys to attend to. And so that's how I got hit and got to the shell hole. And then everything became quiet, and all I could hear were German voices. And I said, oh, my God. And I said, I know I'm out in no man's land, but I didn't know where the hell it was. And then I raised the bandages, and I was able to see. And then I noticed that there were two Germans in the farmhouse above the machine gun position who were firing rifle grenades. And I thought at me, you know, because they're... but not, they weren't firing at me, but you think you're the target. And it's not exactly... So I said, oh, my God. I said, I got to get rid of all these grenades, and I'm going to keep two. But then I remembered I had two mortar shells on my back. And because we worked out a system with our rifle grenades that we could adapt to a 60-millimeter mortar shell and fire it over, but you had to be pretty damn accurate, you know, and make sure you got the distance. And so my whole squad, we're all carrying the mortar shells. And so I said, oh, I got the mortar shells. And I took off my mountain jacket. And when I stood, then I attempted to get up on my knees. Then I realized I got hit in the legs. But at least I got the mortar shells and tossed them as far as I could. Then all the grenades, except two. Because when I got hit, my rifle was blowing out of my hands. And so I didn't have any rifle. And the only thing I had now were just the two grenades. Fortunately, the second wave from another regiment came through on the attack. And then there was a fellow by the name of Ken McDonald. Great soldier. And Ken graduated from Dartmouth in 39, head of his class at Harvard Law School in 42, offered a major's commission. And Ken said, no, I'm off to the mountain troops. And he was a sergeant, and great man, bright as hell, great memory. And Ken comes running down the hill. And he's a bloody mess. He's been bandaged up. You can see his insides. And Ken said, we got to get the hell out of here, Nuke. I said, but Ken, I can't walk. So he came over. And so we worked our way down the Battle Mountain. And we ran into another unit that was in the same position we were at the hedgerow. We told him, you got to move. You got to move out of this hedgerow or you're going to be, you know, they're going to kill you right here. Then we went across the road and then started up the mountainside where our lines were. And Ken and I get to a position, to this day, I don't know whether it was division, you know, corps, army, battalion, you know, big bunker loaded with these officers. Well, this time we're getting a hell of a lot of shelling from the German position. And so we're banging on the doors and saying, let us in. We heard someone guy say, God, you can't let them in. They'll bleed all over our maps. And so we were a little pissed. And, you know, we're just hanging out there with all the shells coming in. And what I do think is that they must have telephoned the battalion aid station, because shortly thereafter came these damn brave medics running on down with the stretchers. And they picked up Ken and me, you know, during all this terrible firing and got us to the battalion aid station. When the battalion aid station was under fire. And so we were on the front, but then we had to go up over a hill. And they put Ken on a Jeep. They put me in an ambulance. There were four guys, and they had two on top and two on the bottom, and I was on the bottom, and one guy above me was bleeding very profusely, coming down. And then as we go up the hill, which is very much exposed to the Germans, and then down some artillery mortar shells came in, and then you could hear the shrapnel going through the cab where we were. And then a man above me, I heard a moan, and then his blood flow increased. So obviously he got hit, and then I sort of heard the death rattle, and he died. And so that was a hairy experience getting out of there. And then went to a field hospital where they operated, and on to general hospitals. So that was it. And
it was some of the most difficult and bloody fighting of the whole war during that Italian campaign. And yet, I know it's been written about, but the Italian campaign doesn't seem to me ever to get the same kind of attention that other places do.
No. I think here's an irony. And I heard this from, I went on a trip one time a few years ago. It was called the Islands of the Western Mediterranean. That didn't interest me so much, but there was a war historian by the name of Sir Michael Howard from Oxford, but he was at the moment teaching at Yale, and so he was one of the speakers. And it turned out that Sir Michael Howard himself was at Cassino.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Yeah. And he, so we discussed things, and I said to Sir Michael, I said, I don't understand why that last attack was so necessary, because the Russians were outside of Berlin, you know, the Americans. Why was it necessary? Because there were a hell of a lot of casualties, and our division suffered more casualties in that attack than on Belvedere. And all I could think was it was for the glory of the generals.
What did he say? Oh, that's what he said.
Yeah, and that's what I always said. You know, of course, when you're in combat, and you don't know what the hell's going on.
Well, yeah.
You know, it's only afterwards when you're studying history, and then you talk to people like Sir Michael Howard, and he said that on June 5th, Mark Clark was ordered by Field Marshal Alexander to, when they broke out of Cassino and Anzio, to go east to hook up with the British 8th Army. Clark disobeyed Field Marshal Alexander and went north to Rome on the 5th. And so he had his 15 minutes of glory while the entire German army escapes. And, you know, maybe the conflict could have been ended then had Mark Clark. And he said Mark Clark should have been court-martialed and probably shot. And Mark Clark was not, I learned this later. I didn't know a damn thing when I was there, but that he was not a very good general. He caused a lot of casualties, and he fought like it was World War I.
Did you fear that you would never ski again?
No.
You didn't?
No. I was told when I was wounded not to ski, you know, to strengthen my leg. And, I met my roommate out in Colorado, and the first thing we did was to go skiing. Then I broke my leg below my wound.
Yeah, I'm sure the doctor must have loved that when you came back in. Did you get a tongue thrashing?
Well, the guy who told me not to ski, I happened to be at, we were at Fort Carson. And this is when they were deactivating the division. And I happened to be in the hospital at the time because I was having a problem with my one of my leg wounds, and I was in there with a lot of other combat wounded guys, and it takes you forever to get out. And when we got out, we just took off, and I was assigned to an MP outfit. Now, for a combat soldier to be assigned to an MP outfit is terrible.
Well, there's another story.
There's another story, yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you. How much skiing do you do now?
Not as much as I'd like. I do a fair amount of skiing.
You do?
Yeah.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center. Veterans Chronicles is available wherever you are. Log on to www.radioamerica.org and click on the podcasting icon. Look for Veterans Chronicles and follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast.